Don't talk a moment about Maurice Bishop and Lee Harvey Oswald, and who is Maurice Bishop?
Maurice Bishop is the name, one of the aliases that David Atlee Phillips took, and it was an unusual moment when one of the leaders of the Cuban exile anti-Castro movement, Antonio Veciana, testified, or rather, I shouldn't say that he testified, but he revealed to the Miami investigator, Gayton Fonzie, that he had seen his own handler, Bishop, which was Phillips, talking to Lee Harvey Oswald. And it was a rare moment that, but then we also have evidence that David Atlee Phillips was seen at the training camps north of Lake Pontchartrain with David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald and others. So I wanted to get back, though, Ralph, to one other point about Jim Garrison and the Italian newspaper Paese Sera, and that is that in the last 5 years, there have been renewed attacks on Jim Garrison. And one of those attacks has said that the only reason that Garrison charged the CIA with having been responsible for the murder of President Kennedy was that he read about this in Paese Sera, and that Paese Sera was blaming the CIA for its interference in European politics only as a result of disinformation sent by the KGB. And one of the things that I had to do then was to go to the surviving editors of Paese Sera and ask them whether it was in fact true that they were targeting the CIA only as a result of the instruction of the KGB. And one of the people I found was a man named Gianfranco Corsini, who was absolutely indignant that the KGB could have influenced this newspaper. And I like what he said to me. We have no reason to trust new CIA documents any more than old KGB documents. And he said that he hoped for the demise of both the CIA and the KGB. Well, that's prescient, isn't it? Because the CIA today is not what it was in John F. Kennedy's time.
Well, I should mention in regard to that, this is Max Holland, who is on the editorial board of The Nation, but is what we call a CIA writer. He actually writes for the CIA website, and it's Holland who has fabricated this ridiculous claim that Paese Sera was a vehicle for the KGB. The irony of it all is that Paese Sera, which is a newspaper of the independent left, it was not tied to the Italian Communist Party, and so what if it had been? But Paese Sera is rather analogous to The Nation itself, ironically enough. But it was Sartre wrote for Paese Sera, Simone de Beauvoir. It was a vehicle of the independent and left intelligentsia across Europe and the United States. It was a daily newspaper with a very substantial following. And this investigative report was concerned with the role of the CIA in Italy. It's only quite fortuitously that they stumbled upon the presence of figures like Clay Shaw on the board of directors of these proprietary central intelligence agency companies that were in Italy.
We're speaking with Joan Mellon, author of this remarkable investigative work, A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. One thing you track down to talk about Clay Shaw is that, as I mentioned earlier, Shaw denied that he ever knew David Ferry. And in your book, you mention that Ferry, in order to rent the plane to go to Dallas, that he actually took out a loan, and it was co-signed by Clay Shaw.
Maya, that was one of the biggest discoveries that I made, and I made it because, I don't know how, now looking back, there was a retired police officer who was the founder of, I think, the Policeman's Union, named Irv Magri. And he said, you have to talk to this former policeman from Kenner because he knows something. And it turned out that this former policeman from Kenner knew a loan officer named Herb Wagner, who had also been with the Civil Air Patrol, knew Ferry very, very well, and also flew missions for the CIA. And one day during Garrison's investigation, Herb Wagner was sitting in his office late at night with this police officer, and he said, I have something, and I wonder whether I should tell Jim Garrison. And he opens up a file drawer at the bottom of the way in the back. He reaches into this file drawer, and he pulls out a loan application. And here's David Ferry, only several weeks before the assassination, applying for a loan. known. And when Wagner, who was called Von Wagner by everyone, very Germanic, and he would not give Ferry the loan. And there's Clay Shaw's signature as the co-signer, showing not only that the two knew each other, but that they were collaborating on this flight that Ferry took to Dallas 2 weeks or maybe even 1 week before the assassination. Now, I want to add here a fact, and that is that when David Ferry was interviewed by the FBI and the Secret Service right after the assassination, he said that he hadn't been in Dallas between 8 and 10 years. So, an obvious lie. Of course, Ferry was never interviewed by the Warren Commission, or, well, he was dead by the time of the House Select Committee investigation. But that loan document, I tried to find the actual document, because wouldn't that be wonderful to have it? And Wagner had died, and all of his files were put in garbage bags, and his wife diligently threw them all away. And so I asked his daughter to go through her garage, see if possibly that file could have survived, but I have to say that it didn't. So I do have the testimony of the police officer and of his daughter, certainly of his daughter, as to his CIA connections.
Now, we're talking here about a relationship between Clay Shaw and David Ferry, who was a contract pilot for the Central Intelligence Agency, as well as for Carlos Marcello of the mob, and a contract pilot who flew operations of sabotage and of carrying agents in and out of Cuba to attack Cuba.
I want to stop you for 1 second, Ralph. And David Ferry was not really Carlos Marcello's pilot. David Ferry worked for G. Ray Gill, who was the lawyer of Carlos Marcello. And Gill had represented Ferry when Ferry was fired from his job as a pilot for Eastern Airlines, and Ferry couldn't pay Gill. So as a favor to Gill, Ferry flew Carlos Marcello. He flew him back from Guatemala to the United States. He got a passport for Marcello and taped it to his chest and all of this. But it's very misleading to try to draw particular mafia connections between David Ferry and Carlos Marcello. That wasn't the case. One of the things that I discover in the book, and I think this is extremely important, is where the story originated that the mafia had been involved in the planning of the assassination of President Kennedy, because that was the second line of defense. It was certainly the second line of defense for the House Select Committee once they received acoustic evidence that showed that there were more than 3 shots fired in Dealey Plaza. That made it impossible for Oswald to have been the single assassin. So if it were a conspiracy, which is more than 2 people involved, then the House Select Committee chief counsel, Robert Blakey, put forth the view, well, it had to be the mafia. That view, that the mafia was involved in planning the assassination, was a brainstorm of J. Edgar Hoover's and the FBI. And I think in the book I show exactly how that happened. The other side of that was to blame Garrison for supporting the mafia. That was the other way of discrediting Garrison. Hoover also thought of that, and he thought a good way to discredit Garrison would be that he protected Carlos Marcello. Now, Carlos Marcello operated out of Jefferson Parish, not out of Orleans Parish. It didn't make any difference. If enough reporters would write it, if enough people would say it, it could be true. Hoover was a master. And so even as recently as when I did my own investigation, people would say to me that Garrison protected Carlos Marcello. It certainly wasn't true. Now, everybody knows everyone in New Orleans, or knew everyone. And certainly Garrison knew Marcello, partly because one of Marcello's many lawyers was Russell Sharnakas, with whom Garrison practiced law, if you could call it that, because Garrison never liked to practice law. And after he lost his job as district attorney, he would occasionally go into the office, and mostly he provided referrals. And so Marcello appeared at that office now and then, and everybody knew everyone. Even my own doctor here in New York City at Mount Sinai Hospital, who was in studying medicine at Tulane University during these days, once told me that he'd ran into Carlos Marcello at a funeral, that he was standing at the back at this funeral chatting with a man. And when he sat down, there's Dr. Carmel Cohn, one of the great doctors of the universe. And one of his friends said, "Do you know who you were talking to back there?" That was Carlos Marcello. So if the gynecologist from Mount Sinai Hospital knew Carlos Marcello or was seen talking to him, you can be sure everybody in Orleans Parish did too. Oh. But Garrison did not help the mafia. And when Robert Blakey and his deputy, Gary Cornwell, tried to connect the mafia to the assassination, I should say that even Aaron Cohn, one of Garrison's bitterest enemies, the head of the Metropolitan Crime Commission, had defended the FBI and said they did not protect the mafia. The mafia had nothing to do with it, and Oswald's family weren't even so much involved with the mafia as Blakey and his co-author, Richard Billings, would have you believe.
Well, let's go into some of the means that were used, like you've been talking about now, but the means to discredit the Garrison investigation and Garrison personally. One of your remarkable chapters in the book, I mean, every chapter is remarkable, but one I particularly found so dramatic and engaging was Chapter 12, White Paper, where you talk about Justice Department lawyer Walter Sheridan and how at Bobby Kennedy's request, Sheridan orchestrated an NBC white paper and also the penetration of Garrison's office.
Before we talk about Walter Sheridan, we have to say who Walter Sheridan was. He was part of the National Security Agency, cleared for the CIA, cleared for the FBI. So he represented many agencies before he went to work primarily for Robert Kennedy at the Justice Department. And what Walter Sheridan's big project was not, first it was not Jim Garrison, it was to destroy Jimmy Hoffa. Three remarkable articles appeared by Fred Cook in The Nation magazine, which exposed exactly what Sheridan did. He used his three favorite methods, wiretapping, blackmail, and bribery, and he managed to get Hoffa convicted. He lied, he cheated, he did everything, and he was the head of what was called Robert Kennedy's wiretapping unit. And Sheridan succeeded. Hoffa was convicted. And the coda to that story is so appalled was Chief Justice Earl Warren that he dissent when the Hoffa conviction came up before the United States Supreme Court for review, Earl Warren dissented and wanted to let Hoffa go because of the methods that Walter Sheridan used. He was an absolute thug. He was a criminal himself. Now, he's finished with Hoffa. What does he do? He's sent down to New Orleans to destroy Jim Garrison. Before he gets there, he establishes credentials. He's suddenly a producer for NBC television. He had produced one other thing in Detroit in order to pave the way, and the CIA assets down there, such as Hugh Ainsworth, who was working for Newsweek magazine at the time, Ainsworth wrote an article about Sheridan in which he mentioned Sheridan as a reporter and as a news producer four times in the space of a one-page article. Okay, here comes Sheridan. He comes down to New Orleans and pretends to be investigating the Kennedy assassination, and what he's doing is destroying the Garrison investigation. And the product would be this white paper, which did in fact appear on NBC. What Sheridan tried to do and he failed to do, the one thing he failed to do was to destroy Garrison's chief witness, whom we talked about earlier, Perry Russo. And he tried to bribe Russo, and he tried to tell Russo, I'll get you a job in Los Angeles. Where would you like to go? California. All you have to do is to say that everything that you told Jim Garrison was a lie. Well, this is extremely interesting because the Shaw defense went to great lengths to discredit Perry Russo. It could only be because they believed that what he said was true. And Russo had testified at a preliminary hearing. Now, Garrison had called a preliminary hearing on the evidence, which he didn't have to do. Usually it's the defense that calls a preliminary hearing, but Garrison wanted to show what his evidence was. And I should mention for the people who are legal-minded that at the time in the state of Louisiana, the prosecution did not have to give its witness list to the defense. So here's Garrison exposing his chief witness, Perry Russo, to the public and gave the other side a chance for 2 years to attempt to destroy him. And that was what Walter Sheridan went to New Orleans to do.
Well, this shows the collaboration of NBC, the network itself, with Attorney General Robert Kennedy and the FBI to prevent the real investigation of the Kennedy assassination.
Well, more than that, to destroy the witnesses, to threaten them with death, to threaten them with prison, to blackmail them, to bribe them, to use any method possible.
Well, Russo was a very courageous young fellow. He worked for an insurance company. He was quite a character. And he immediately went into Garrison's office and signed an affidavit. Garrison knew that Sheridan and James Phelan, who was another media asset who was reporting to the FBI and the CIA, Garrison knew that these people were getting at Russo. And so what happened, and maybe Garrison was wrong to do this, but he wired Russo so that everything that happened there was on tape. So as a result of that, I have the tapes of Sheridan's attempts to, and Phelan's attempts to subvert Perry Russo. Perry Russo was strong. Perry Russo did not cave in. He went to the district attorney's office and signed an affidavit against Sheridan. Garrison then indicted Sheridan. Now, being the state of Louisiana in 1967 and 1968, there was no law against obstruction of justice. So Garrison charged Walter Sheridan with various charges, bribery and so forth. And, of course, Sheridan was protected by the federal courts and never went to trial.
You have to summarize, what is it that Rousseau actually had witnessed? Where was he present? What was he testifying to, and what was its significance?
Now, we talked about that a little earlier. What Rousseau testified to was that meeting at David Ferry's apartment when Clay Shaw, who went under the name of Clem Bertrand, and David Ferry discussed the assassination, how President Kennedy would be killed, and what their alibis would be. Now, I should, at this point, for people who don't remember the Garrison case, talk about what that name Clem or Clay Bertrand meant. And this is, of course, part of the record and even part of the Warren Commission. And that is, on the Saturday after President Kennedy was shot, a New Orleans lawyer, also another mob lawyer named Dean Andrews, was in Hotel Dieu Hospital recovering from pneumonia when he received a telephone call from someone named Clay Bertrand, whom he knew, asking him to go to Dallas to represent Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, Andrews was too sick to go, so he, and this is corroborated, he called a fellow lawyer named Monk Zeldin, and he asked him to go in his place, go to Dallas and represent Lee Harvey Oswald. And as they were talking in a second conversation on Sunday morning, Zeldin said, "Nobody has to go to Dallas. Your boy just got shot." And there's Jack Ruby had killed Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, when the Warren Commission did talk to Dean Andrews, he never identified Clay Bertrand. And of course, what Garrison, who knew everyone, of course, Garrison knew Dean Andrews. So the first official interview that Garrison did when he resumed his investigation in 1966 was to have lunch with Dean Andrews and to try to get the identification. Who was Clay Bertrand? Who was this Bertrand? And at this gathering that we were talking about, at which Perry Rousseau was present, Clay Shaw, who was Clay Bertrand, and I prove that up and down, although it has been difficult for Garrison to prove, but I prove it, I think, further. Clay Shaw went under the name Clem Bertrand. Now, it turns out, through various research that I did, that name that Clay Shaw used was the alias that he chose as when he was helping fellow homosexuals in New Orleans when they were arrested against these, what were called in those days, crimes against nature. And the irony of that is, of course, that Garrison was a liberal. I want to mention that Garrison was a liberal. He did not want to prosecute anybody. Ferry was prosecuted, by the way, in Jefferson Parish, not in Orleans Parish. He didn't want to prosecute anybody for these victimless crimes. He really didn't care about what people's sexual preferences were. And despite what Jack Anderson wrote in one of his columns, during the trial of Clay Shaw, Garrison never once called a witness who in any way could reveal what Clay Shaw's sexual practices were. I do that in the book, but certainly Garrison never used that. And as a result, Garrison lost many witnesses who could have testified to the fact that Clay Shaw was indeed the Clay Bertrand who telephoned Dean Andrews to ask him to go to Dallas and represent Lee Harvey Oswald.
But also, Sheridan didn't limit himself to trying to get at Perry Rousseau. He also enlisted Gordon Novell to penetrate Garrison's office. And could you talk some about Gordon?
That's interesting. Gordon Novell remains a New Orleans character. And if you read a recent issue of Vanity Fair, there's a long discussion of Gordon Novell, who's saying that he was an advisor to Michael Jackson in his recent trial. So Gordon Novell is a New Orleans character who was available, who was an FBI informant, and whom Sheridan used, as Maya says, to penetrate Garrison's office, to steal documents, to steal lie detector testimonies, to photographs, whatever he could get his hands on. And so simultaneously, Gordon Novell was reporting to Walter Sheridan, and he was also reporting every day, really, to the FBI. And thanks to the Oliver Stone and to the JFK Act, we have all of those reports from Gordon Novell to the FBI that are available to everyone in the National Archives. One of the things that Gordon Novell did for Walter Sheridan was put him on to Marlene Mancuso, who was Gordon Novell's ex-wife and who was a Garrison witness. And then Walter Sheridan tried to subvert Marlene Mancuso, also offering her a job on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. She was quite beautiful. She had been a Miss New Orleans. And Walter Sheridan promised that he could get her a job on The Tonight Show if she would take back the testimony that she had given for Jim Garrison.
And what was that testimony?
That testimony had to do with the robbery of the Schlumberger ammunitions dump out in Houma, Louisiana, which was masterminded by Guy Bannister, by Gordon Novell, possibly with David Phillips' authorization, the same David Phillips that Ralph was referring to as Maurice Bishop. And they stole all these grenades and various war material, which they then trucked into New Orleans, ultimately bound for Miami and for the efforts against Fidel Castro.
Joan, David Attlee Phillips was the head of station for Latin America, and in particular for Mexico, of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, chief of operations for Western Hemisphere, working very closely with J.M. Wave, the CIA station in Miami. He wasn't actually chief of station in Mexico City, but that was under his jurisdiction.
And David Attlee Phillips is a central and coordinating figure with respect to the key participants in the execution of John Kennedy.
Certainly David Attlee Phillips was involved. And he wrote his memoirs. It's called The Amlash Legacy, and it's in the form of a novel. And his wife has kept that undercover, but an assassination researcher managed to look at some of it during depositions in a lawsuit. And so we see that David Attlee Phillips depicts himself as Lee Harvey Oswald's handler in his fictionalized version of the Kennedy assassination.
Well, in fact, that fictionalized version of the Kennedy assassination by David Attlee Phillips actually elaborates the entire scenario of setting up a Fidelista as the fall guy for the assassination and then carrying it out as a government operation.
That's right. The CIA's original plan was to blame Fidel Castro for the assassination and that this would precipitate an invasion of Cuba, which was what the CIA and the Pentagon at that time wanted and which John F. Kennedy did not want.
9/11 of the day.
Well, the Vietnam, I mean, in a way, because what happened was that although they did not get there after the death of President Kennedy, they did not get their war in Cuba. They got something even better, which was the protracted war in Vietnam, because so many more profits accumulated to the oil people, the helicopter people, and the Western interests that profited so much from the Vietnam War. And we see these same people profiting, of course, from the Iraq War. One of the interesting things that Garrison wanted to do was to really investigate George Brown and to look at Brown and Root and to see, and he discovered their CIA connections. The documents were not available to Garrison, although they are to us. And so Garrison focused on Brown and Root, and here is Kellogg, Brown and Root at the forefront of the, I don't know, is it billions of dollars that they have made from the contracts in Iraq?
Right. We had discussed the evolution, development of Brown and Root in our Crony Capitalism series, and Brown is very much connected with Lyndon Baines Johnson. And it was Lyndon Baines Johnson, even when he was in Congress, that got Franklin Delano Roosevelt to award to Brown the original road building and then also dam building monies. And then later, it was Brown who promoted Lyndon Baines Johnson in his congressional campaign. There's very close connections. So,
I just, before we go any further, I want to make a point that I do not subscribe to the view that Lyndon Johnson was involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
What was interesting to me is that you're saying that Garrison wanted to look further into the role of Kellogg Brown, and then it was Kellogg Brown. Later it became
Brown and Root. I think
Brown
at the time
Root.
It was Brown.
It was Brown and Root, and then later became Kellogg Brown and Root, and then they were part of Halliburton much, much later.
Joan, you discuss a CIA accountant with top secret clearance named James Wilcott, who I mentioned before had been with Oswald at Itsugi, retired in 1966. There's an extraordinary passage here where you cite Wilcott as follows. Oswald received a full-time salary for operational work. There were at least six or seven people who knew and believed Oswald to be an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he concludes, Ruby was paid by the CIA to do away with Oswald. The plan was to kill Kennedy, link Oswald to Castro, and use the pretext to invade Cuba.
I think that's all correct. I think that Wilcock was, the House Select Committee attempted to discredit him, attempted to show, well, he couldn't be right because the person he cites was no longer there at the time and so forth. It's pretty lame. I think he was telling the truth. I think because people often say, how come there are no loose ends? How come nobody came forward? How come no one said anything? And the fact is that isn't true. People have said things. There have been loose ends, and that was just an unfortunate for them fact. This man did not testify for Jim Garrison, although I think he would have wanted to.
Well, after all, Joan, after it was disclosed that Jim Garrison was going to indict David Ferry, he was found dead. At the same time, Eladio Del Valle came up with a severe case of hatchet in the head in Miami, in Key Biscayne. Mary Sherman is found dead. How many witnesses, people who had come forward or had guilty knowledge, were silenced and eliminated and disappeared and murdered in the course of this process?
Well, I think certainly the witnesses were afraid. And only last week, when I was talking to the barber, Leah McGee, who gave Oswald the haircut, he said, you know, I found the new witness. I found somebody who was interviewed by the FBI right after the assassination, and he was interviewed with a woman named Gladys Palmer, who was really should have been one of the Clinton witnesses. She had been a stripper for Jack Ruby at the Carousel Club, and she was seen with Oswald quite frequently during the spring and summer of 1963. And the FBI had thought that this man and Gladys Palmer were quote-unquote boyfriend and girlfriend, and they were taken in to the jailhouse at St. Francisville and questioned by the FBI. And I said, oh, I'd really like to talk to this man. And the barber said, well, he's terrified. He's still terrified to this day.
Give the example of Rose Cherami.
And then there's Rose Cherami. Well, Rose Cherami, of course, was not afraid. And she was at the East, at the East Louisiana State Hospital at Jackson during the day of the Kennedy assassination, and was predicted the assassination, and talked to some Cubans who were with her, and so she knew that the assassination was coming. And before she could be a Garrison witness, she was murdered in 1965 walking on a deserted highway in Big Sandy, Texas. Who would hitchhike on a deserted road instead of a main road? And she was hit by a car and died.
She also said, after all, Rose Cherami, that she was a stripper or a hooker for Ruby, and then she witnessed Ruby and Oswald together.
Yes.
Frequently at the Carousel Club.
That was one of the, she was one of the witnesses who could show that Ruby and Oswald knew each other. There have been quite a few. My book is chock filled with witnesses who saw Oswald and Ruby together at the Carousel Club and elsewhere.
We're speaking with author Joan Mellon, investigative author of A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. Joan is decades friend and companion, and we know the methodical way in which he approaches every one of the subjects for which he has written books and analysis, and in the way she approaches life.
And what I'm talking about here, brothers and sisters, is a profile in courage. You hear a quiet-spoken, indefatigable author, investigator, researcher, professor, who has personally, physically, been present with the killers, the contract killers, the plug uglies and the thugs, the actual assassins, sat with them, met with their families, pressed them, pushed them, extracted information from them, extraordinary documentation, first-hand witnesses that people paled before the prospect of even contacting. And there was Joan traveling on her own for almost 8 years from place to place, meeting these people and gaining their confidence and convincing them of the necessity at this point in time to come forward. And she has obtained their data, she has obtained their verification, she has contained, if you like, their first-hand accounts. It is just a breathtaking achievement. And as you read it, you will be astonished at the audacity, the courage, and the perseverance that has produced this extraordinary work.
We have so much more to discuss in terms of the interviews, and particularly the role of Robert Kennedy in sabotaging the investigation, why he would do such a thing, why would he sabotage the investigation of his own brothers, his close brother to whom he was very close in the assassination, and what this means. We're also going to discuss later on in the show the role of the top echelon of the CIA and the involvement of Richard Helms and James Angleton and others in this assassination.
Brothers and sisters, point man for the murder of Patrice Lumumba was a man named Frank Carlucci. The head of the Carlyle Group, man named Frank Carlucci, a key figure in the Central Intelligence Agency operation that entailed the assassination of John F. Kennedy, a man named Frank Carlucci, a key collaborator of Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., a man named Frank Carlucci. It all comes together here, the murder state, the criminalization of the state, the execution of the head of state, the treason at the top, the detail, the particularity, the eliciting of the witnesses, the establishment of the documents, and the connections, connecting the dots, bringing it all together. A Farewell to Justice by Joan Mellon. You have to have it, brothers and sisters, because it illuminates decades of the decomposition of what passes for the state in this country.
You were talking about Rose Cherami, and then here on page 206 it says, back in New Orleans, Garrison uncovered Rose's 20 aliases. Her name appeared everywhere but in the Warren Commission index of names. The state police had not taken her photograph or prints. And then you have a person named Frugier. I don't remember.
Francis Frugier was right. A state trooper who ultimately, with Mrs. Dischler, became the investigators for Jim Garrison up at Clinton and Jackson. And Frugier enters the story here because he was a state policeman in charge of narcotics, and so he knew Rose Cherami very well because she plied her trade, prostitution, drugs, on Route 190 down there from Opelousas to the border of Texas in Beaumont, which, again, names that we know because of the recent catastrophes down there. And so when Rose was thrown out of a car, this is the time number one, and she's dazed, she's on drugs, and Francis Frugier is called. That's where the story starts as far as Rose Cherami is concerned. And Francis Frugier is told to take her to East, to the East Louisiana State Hospital. And while Rose is with him, she's talking, and she's telling how Oswald and Ruby knew each other and how the assassination was planned and how she was with the Cubans. And so Francis Frugier enters the story at that time.
And it says here that her death certificate reads, quote, bullet in the head, although hospital records mention no bullet hole.
I don't know about that, and Garrison could never find it. The motorist who supposedly ran Rose over was not at the address that he gave, and Garrison had no way of investigating there. I want to say something else about Garrison, and that is how short-staffed he was. He only had a few people, three or four people, working on this case. He had very little money. He had to borrow money from the Volkswagen dealer down there. He had a small group called Truth and Consequences, and for a while they gave $100 a month for his investigation, and then they stopped after a few months. He really was working on a shoestring, and so there were a lot of areas that he couldn't investigate, and I think the death of Rose Cherami was one. Another was Paese Serra and all the information that they had given about the CIA's role in European politics. Garrison just did not have the resources to follow up on these aspects of the case.
And Joan, many of his witnesses who he nailed, and they were key and central witnesses, they simply went into other states, and then the governors refused to extradite them.
That's true, and I think we have to realize it was Walter Sheridan, on behalf of the Department of Justice, who telephoned the governors of those states where the witnesses were and ordered them not to extradite. It was true in Ohio in the case of Gordon Novell. Gordon Novell had been charged as a material witness by Garrison. He wanted him to talk to the grand jury, and the governor of Ohio just refused to extradite Novell. The same was true of a woman named Sandra Moffat, who had been Perry Russo's companion at the party that I referred to, where David Ferry and Clay Shaw were, and not a single witness was extradited by any state back to New Orleans to help Jim Garrison.
You know, it puts me in mind of the time when we formed the Who Killed Kennedy Committee in London. That is the moment when the established media became absolutely rabid. The Guardian at the time published an editorial in which they said that I was a pathological American who had a psychopathic loathing for the country in which he had been bred. They didn't say spawned. And I remember, Joan, when we were seeing Jim in 1969, I was joking with Jim about the kinds of attacks to which we had each been subjected over the years. And as Jim was so clear about this, you know, if they don't off you, it's character assassination. Jim was subjected to the most relentless reinvention, character assassination. Even the vindication in a court of law wasn't sufficient when this fabrication about his taking bribes from pinball machine operators, which was a Justice Department plot against Garrison, was exposed. The New York Times to this day continues to write as if he had been convicted of this. And Jim used to say the following. He says, you tell it all as soon as you know it. Because there is no other immunity from the fate of so many of these witnesses, because the more you make noise about what we know, and that's what Free Speech Radio is about, brothers and sisters, that's what Taking Aim is for. You tell it all as soon as you know it. You get it out there. You mobilize people around this understanding and this truth so that the consequence of doing us in, to put it bluntly, is that you call attention to the information that you've been disseminating. They can only attempt to assail us and destroy our character that they did relentlessly to Jim Garrison. Jim Garrison was the man who was going to be governor of Louisiana. In fact, he had been marked by as a coming figure in Democratic Party politics. He may well have been considered as a vice presidential candidate or beyond. His political career he cared less about. He sacrificed every prospect to his dedication to unfolding this truth and to exposing what he called the war complex. He said, what was the phrase that he used, Joan?
Well, he used to say the war machine.
Yes, but I meant in terms of let justice be done.
Oh, that's written on his grave. Let justice be done, though the heavens fall. And his children put that on his tombstone. I hope the grave is intact over there in the cemetery in Metairie.
When we sent out notices about today's special, the three-hour special, people then forwarded onto other lists, and someone called us. In fact, our webmaster, Mark Bilk, our archivist, Mark Bilk, called and said that on one of the lists, somebody had sent back a notice say, no, Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin at this day and age. Well, I recommend that this person must read this book because it shows clearly who Lee Harvey Oswald was, and his relationship to Clay Shaw, David Ferry, and Juan Valdez. And Joan, let's continue with the role of Robert Kennedy into obstructing this investigation. And you mentioned before that Garrison had very few investigators working with him. Some of them were inexperienced. He didn't have the funds. And we talked about Walter Sheridan planting Gordon Novell. But there were other people who were planted into Garrison.
Talk about James Phelan.
Well, wait a moment. What Maya is talking about there is the CIA document that several investigators found. The CIA allowed some of the House Select Committee investigators to look at documents. They could not take notes. They could not remove them or copy them, but they could look. And one of the documents that they found was a list of the plants in Garrison's office. And among them was his best friend, who was his chief criminal investigator, Pershing Gervais. And another was Gordon, I can't recall actually what's in the book, it's not even published yet, but I think that there was Raymond Beck, who was an FBI plant, and there's a whole list of people. There was William Wood, whom Garrison had nicknamed Boxley, and these were all people who were sent in to subvert Garrison's investigation. One of the people whose name was not on the list, I don't think, was a young Englishman named Tom Bethel, who was presented himself as Garrison's researcher, and they were so shorthanded that they needed him to compile the list of witnesses for the trial of Clay Shaw. And what Tom Bethel did was one day in the hallway of the federal courthouse, he handed the witness list to Clay Shaw's defense, to the lawyers for Clay Shaw. Tom Bethel. Now, James Phelan was not in Garrison's office. James Phelan was just a supposed writer for the Saturday Evening Post who turns out to report everything that he did to the FBI and the CIA, and those documents exist. Maya had a question about Robert.
Because this is something that is so startling to people, and you go into this in great detail about why Bobby Kennedy would obstruct the investigation of his brother's assassination.
I was really finished. The book was in proofs, and I just wanted to made one last attempt to try to figure out why Robert Kennedy tried to destroy Jim Garrison. And Jim Garrison, during his time, was absolutely perplexed by this. And Garrison would say, if my brother were killed, I'd want to know what happened to him. He knew that Robert Kennedy was working against him, but he couldn't figure out why. And so I went down to Miami, and thanks to Gerald Patrick Hemming, who was one of the soldiers of fortune, who was involved in training people to go murder Fidel Castro, that Gerald Patrick Hemming remained friendly with one of the Cubans who was close to Robert Kennedy. And because of Gerald Patrick Hemming's relationship with this Cuban, his name was Angelo Kennedy, who changed his name from Angelo Morgado to Angelo Kennedy, I was able to have a very good conversation with Mr. Kennedy and to discuss what Bobby Kennedy knew and when he knew it. And I found out that a group of Cubans, among whom was Angelo, were working for Robert Kennedy. They knew that something was happening in New Orleans, lest anyone doubt that the assassination of John F. Kennedy was planned and implemented as much in the state of Louisiana as it was in Dallas in November of 1963. So these Cubans went up to New Orleans to see what was happening. And also, by the way, one of their roles was to protect John F. Kennedy. If they could find out whether there was an assassination plot brewing in New Orleans, And it would be from some Cuban who was disaffected and angry at President Kennedy because President Kennedy did not give full military support to the invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. Then maybe they could protect Kennedy, and they knew that there was so much talk of an assassination. So the Cubans go to New Orleans, and they're mixing in anti-Castro circles. They find Lee Harvey Oswald. They report about Lee Harvey Oswald to Robert Kennedy. So here we have Robert Kennedy, and this is something that has never come out, that Robert Kennedy knew about Lee Harvey Oswald and knew quite a lot about him prior, this is several months prior to the assassination. They also discovered that Lee Harvey Oswald was an FBI informant. Now, this in case anyone doubts that Lee Harvey Oswald was a government agent. And Robert Kennedy thought it over, and he said, well, if he's working for the FBI, if the FBI has him under control, we don't have to worry about him. Naivete of Robert Kennedy. And so they let him go. And Angelo Kennedy then turns out to have been one of the three men, and this is extremely important, three men, two Cubans, and a man named Leon Oswald visited a Cuban exile in Dallas named Sylvia Odio in September of 1963. And they're talking about her help because her father was in jail in Cuba, helping them to do damage to Fidel Castro, to organize a movement against Castro. And one of them was called Angelo, which whom we know is Angelo Morgado. One of them called himself Leopoldo, whose name was not Leopoldo. And out of Angelo's hearing, a couple of days later, Leopoldo calls back Sylvia Odio and says, you know, that Leon Oswald was really crazy. He said that some Cuban should kill John F. Kennedy because of what he did at the Bay of Pigs. Well, that sets up Oswald, doesn't it? It helps the framing of Oswald by showing that he was talking about the assassination 3 months before the assassination. So that meant he was involved, right? Of course, Oswald always said he was a patsy. Well, here is Oswald being set up to take the blame for the assassination. Now, Angelo did not know about that call, and so during the weekend of the assassination, when he watches television like everyone else and sees Lee Harvey Oswald named as the assassin of President Kennedy, and here he was with Oswald at Sylvia Odio's in September. Well, he just said that he was viscerally sick. He just vomited. He was so upset. The person who made that call, Leopoldo, turns out to have been a CIA asset named Bernardo de Torres. And also with Angelo, both of them, veterans of the Bay of Pigs invasion. And one of the interesting things that I discovered was that when Bernardo de Torres was deposed by the House Select Committee, the CIA visited the lawyers of the House Select Committee prior to the deposition and told them exactly what they could and could not ask Bernardo de Torres. And he was not to be asked anything about the period of time just prior to the assassination. And because the House Select Committee investigation was really run by the CIA, he was not asked those questions. And Gaetan Fonzi, who was the Miami investigator and who had brought them Bernardo de Torres, is sitting there, and he thought to himself, and this was a wonderful line that he gave me, anyone watching, anyone looking at this deposition would have thought, of all the hundreds of thousands of Cubans, why did the House Select Committee choose this guy to bring in for questioning? And, of course, Bernardo de Torres, I don't believe, is in the United States any longer.
Now, in relation to this, we have to be clear. When you're down in Miami and you're talking to these people and you're meeting with them, the JM Wave people and so on, you're talking about contract killers who were in the business of killing Fidel Castro.
Angelo Kennedy is not so young anymore, and he laughed and he said, don't think, and I think one of the quotes that I put in the book, he said, don't think because I'm so nice. I was a killer. I was an executioner.
Now, not only was he a killer, but what's very important here, Joan, is, and I don't think anybody has ever uncovered this except you, whose killer was he? Talk about that.
No, he was not President Kennedy's killer.
What was the relationship of Robert Kennedy to this plan to assassinate Fidel? And this
Well, they didn't. Of course, he was not the killer because they did not assassinate Fidel Castro, who's we have to say is alive today. But I want to make absolutely clear of Angelo Morgado's affection for the Kennedys and his hatred of Fidel Castro. Yes. And his willingness to participate in Robert Kennedy's personal set of plots against Fidel Castro, that's certainly true. And these are plots independent of the CIA's plots against Fidel Castro. But Angelo, his affection for the Kennedys exists to this day. And one of the things that he did was he showed me one of his prized possessions, and he comes out of the room with a photograph of John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and Teddy Kennedy. And it was tremendously moving to me to see his affection for these
notwithstanding, I think what I think is of some significance here is, as you have documented, Robert Kennedy had an assassination team plan and project for the execution of Fidel Castro.
That's true.
And indeed, the people who were involved in this, which included the connection with Lee Harvey Oswald, meant that for Robert Kennedy to expose the murder of his brother meant to expose his own plans with some of these very same people for the execution of Castro.
That's true, and also that he even knew Oswald. And one of the people down there, no one we would want to know, but one of the people said, "Goddamn, Bobby's got his brother killed." So
well,
his mixing into
here,
those events led, you know, there's a connection, certainly, Ralph.
I can remember, Joan, when I was at the time giving evidence with Dick Gregory before the Rockefeller Commission in 1975, and later I was on this Tom Snyder show, and as always I was being asked, well, what, Robert Kennedy, a former attorney general, you think he would be quiet if there was a CIA involvement in the murder of John Kennedy? And I said to Tom Snyder, you judge the silence in the light of the evidence, not the evidence in the light of the silence. What you've done here, because I said these people have blood on their hands. You think he woke up one day and said, isn't that interesting? Patrice Lumumba bit the dust in Congo. Isn't that nice? Yon Sosa and the leaders of the Guatemalan guerrilla movement have been murdered. You think that these people are immune to the carrying out of executions? They're going to expose the murder apparatus of which they are an integral part. You've documented it. You've elucidated it. You've exposed it. And you've explained not just the indifference to the investigation of Jim Garrison, but the fanatical manner in which Robert Kennedy and his instrument Sheridan sought to destroy Garrison, to eliminate witnesses, and to shut down the investigation.
They didn't succeed, of course.
They couldn't succeed.
Garrison stayed till the end, even until his death, trying to find out what happened.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, www.wbai.org. We're speaking with investigative author Joan Mellon, the author of 17 remarkable books, and this one tops them all, Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. When we come up on the next hour, we're going to be discussing more about the CIA. This has been a three-hour special, Taking Aim. There is no other station like it in the world, and that's why so many people are listening via the internet to WBAI around the world. And we get letters from people in far away as Australia regularly letting
Australia and Norway and China and Cuba and Greece and just recently Mexico in response to our series on creating the next pandemic.
This is a book that you will read over and over again. You will underline, you will mark up, that you can see all my marks. Ralph is even more. And Ralph is somebody who's been working on the issue of the Kennedy assassination for countless years. Over 40 years. And still, Joan has been able to shock, surprise, and I must say, please Ralph, to no end with all that she has compiled, prepared, and the remarkable analysis involved in A Farewell to Justice. Not only is this the corroboration of what Jim Garrison was doing, it goes much, much further. I wanted to quote something from your book on page 174, where you write, Oswald Garrison concluded had been, quote, an employee of the CIA, which skillfully nurtured him and convinced him that he was performing undercover intelligence assignments for the government. End quote. Oswald was, quote, bright and deeply experienced, if low level, and had he not been eliminated, he'd still be talking, Garrison said. The agency, Garrison was firmly convinced, was behind the assassination. The CIA is a major menace to the democracy I thought we lived in, he told the press.